Perfect. Great.
Is that good?
Yes. So, welcome.
Thank you. All right, you all, hello. Thank you for being here on the last day of class when it is really nice out. So, there's windows and there's the sunlight and I feel the breeze. So we'll experience a little bit of the outside in here. We'll have a good time and then we'll say goodbye. That's what we'll do. So Charles gave a nice introduction to what I'll be talking about. I'll be talking about my new book, and it's such a joy. Thank you, Charles, to be back at UVA and to be in this class, because this particular class, a paper for which became my dissertation, and then out of the book that was my dissertation came the seed for this next book. And bless you. And for lots of reasons, then, the kinds of questions you've been asking this semester, or these are the kinds of questions we asked when I took this class, how do ideas of God shape ways communities are engaging the social order, right? What role do European and American, especially in the 19th century, Protestant theologies play in informing an American search for beloved community, and what are social consequences of religious belief? So those are the sorts of things you've been thinking about all semester, I think. And those are the kinds of questions that are really important to me, too. And so I end up addressing all of those questions in some fashion or other in this new book about the international roots of the civil rights movement. And so what I'm doing is, as Charles mentioned, I'm talking about a period, I think, a little bit before what you all talk about in this class. So I'm looking at the 1930s to the 1950s. And I'm looking at a particular network of Black American Christian intellectuals and activists. And one of the things I saw happening is that they are looking at independence movements. And they're looking at these independence movements, as I'll talk about in a little bit more detail, especially in India and especially in places in West Africa. And they're seeing that, the ways in which people are fighting for independence is something that maybe we could do here in the United States. That Black Americans, in fact, need independence from Jim Crow. And what would that look like? And especially in India, the ways that the social movement is engaging with religious traditions, that maybe could be something that Christians could do in the United States, but that we have to really understand in its particular context, understand it idiomatically before we can then translate it here. And so what happens over these decades that I'm looking at is a lot of that kind of study and groundwork that makes it possible then for someone like King, who we all sort of know somehow that King was Gandhian, but what are those connections? And it turns out the connections are that they're the people that I'm talking about. So the group I'm talking about in the time period from the 30s to the 50s included professors and public intellectuals like Howard Thurman, who I'll talk about later today in more detail, Benjamin Mays and William Stuart Nelson, each of whom met with Mohandas Gandhi in India. The group includes ecumenical movement leaders, notably YWCA women. So the YWCA is really important to this, including Juliet Derricote, Sue Bailey Thurman, and Celestine Smith. And the network included pioneers of Black Christian nonviolence, like James Farmer, the founder of CORE, Polly Murray, and Bayard Rustin. So people in this group that I'm talking about became mentors and advisors to and co-workers with King. So they became... No more, breeze. So they become the links between Gandhi, who was killed in 1948, and King, who becomes a national figure in 1956. So this afternoon, I'll talk for about half an hour, and I'll hit on three things. One is I'll talk about a Christian Black internationalism, and I'll identify what that means. I'll talk for just a second about a debate within religious studies about what religion is. And then the third thing I'll do is I'll look at one of these international exchanges and some of the resulting political and religious reflection. And I hope that in talking about all this, this can hit on some of the questions you've been asking all semester about the role of Christianity in American social movements. Okay. All right. So first, to a Black Christian internationalism. All right. So the Christian activists and intellectuals that I write about were part of an international turn in Black political thought that happened especially after the First World War. So Black internationalism, that category, is about a comparison between racism in the United States and racism and imperial oppression in other parts of the world. So during this period, though Black Americans were a numerical minority in the United States, they came to understand themselves as part of a global majority of peoples of color who were part of a worldwide struggle against white supremacy that included the struggles of blacks and Indians in South Africa, as well as Hindus and Muslims in India, and Aboriginal peoples in Australia, among many others. So there came to be this kind of global sense of an internationalism, and a particularly a black internationalism. Now, for those of you who know this history, you know that black internationalism is wide and deep and diverse. So even as we talk about just the American context, we can look from the 1800s, from Martin Delaney to Alexander Crummell, into the mid to late 20th century when you have Stokely Carmichael, who becomes Kwame Ture, Malcolm X, of course, and Assata Shakur, who still lives in exile in Cuba. So it's a lot that black internationalism describes. Now, the period between World War I and World War II is considered a high point in black internationalism. I want to say a high point because I hope that there is future high points, right? And historians in this period often cite Du Bois and Garvey as kind of the paradigmatic black internationalists. So W.E.B. Du Bois, for his part, led a series of pan-African conferences between 1919 and 1945 that stoked an international discussion of politics and strategy among black people throughout the diaspora, many of whom would become leaders of anti-colonial movements in the Caribbean and in West Africa, in East Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa. And he edited The Crisis, the NAACP journal whose international focus came to exemplify the rest of the mid-century black press. So the black press is really important kind of undercurrent in this story. During this same period, Jamaican Marcus Garvey moved the headquarters of his United Negro Improvement Association from Kingston to Harlem. And during this period, he has helped to establish more than 1,900 UNIA chapters in over 40 countries and colonies. So this is a global movement that he has. Now, he is often pitted against Du Bois because he rejected integration, which was the goal of Du Bois's led Niagara movement, and he proposed that blacks throughout the diaspora return to Africa and found an African empire. So typically when people tell the story of black internationalism, these are kind of the two exemplars and the two poles and the two options. The folks I'm talking about, this network of Christian intellectuals, represent a third kind of black internationalism, one particularly rooted in Protestant missions. So before the Great Migration, or at least before its first wave, and the development of a self-consciously internationalist politics in the urban north, black Christians throughout the country, since the late 1700s, had been hearing visiting missionary stories from abroad. So they were hearing stories from the Caribbean, they were hearing stories especially from West Africa, so they were developing their own sense of the international. Now, an important connection in this history between black missionaries who go abroad and come back and share stories is one of the things that happens especially after the Civil War and the growth of black denominations throughout the country is you have black denominations themselves sending missionaries to the Caribbean and especially to West Africa. And one of the most important things these missionaries do is they start schools, especially secondary schools. So they're starting secondary schools in West Africa for West African students to go to. Now what's happening in the early 20th century is those West African students who are going to school in American black mission schools in West Africa, instead of when they have the chance to go to school abroad, instead of going to England, which used to be kind of their only option, they're now coming to the United States and they're going to HBCUs. They're going to historically black colleges and universities. So for example, Kwame Nkrumah and Nnamdi Azikiwe studied at Lincoln University outside Philly. It's an HBCU outside Philly, and at Howard in DC in the 20s and 30s. Nkrumah would become the first prime minister of a free Ghana and Azikiwe the first president of a free Nigeria. And both in 57 and 60 respectively, and both led independence movements that they described as nonviolent, Christian, and Gandhian. Before there was a movement in the States, really. Bayard Rustin developed important relationships with Nkrumah and Azikiwe when he went to West Africa in 1952 to glean lessons from their independence movements. Now, Bayard Rustin grew up in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and when he met them, he talked college sports with both men who had been athletes at Lincoln. So he kind of knew what was going on with Lincoln sports and was able to talk with them about that. Rustin later was instrumental in getting King invited to Ghana's independence celebration in 1957. It was Kreda and Martin King's first international trip. And in 1959, Rustin returned to Ghana to organize an international pan-African pacifist protest of French nuclear testing in the Sahara. So part of these relationships were enabled by these American missionaries who had gone and started these schools in West Africa. Okay, so right now, if you're following, I'm in the middle of talking about what makes a kind of Christian black internationalism and how it's rooted in Protestant missions, and I just mentioned Rustin. I want to have a little aside here because I'm not going to talk about Rustin today except for this. But in the process of writing this book, for you all who know who Bayard Rustin is, Bayard Rustin's best known as the organizer of the March on Washington. He's best known as a key advisor to King. He is both those things. And he is so much more. He's finally starting to get some attention on his own right. And one of the things that I found in researching this book and in writing so much about him is that he is an incredibly sophisticated thinker and actually a religious thinker. And people miss this for a lot of reasons. They miss this because he's an activist and they don't appreciate all of the intellectual work that good activism requires. They also miss it, frankly, because he's Quaker. And for folks trained in theology and religious studies, we don't necessarily know how to read and understand Quaker categories. So we don't understand why separation, for example, is a really important category to him. So all that's to say he's been missed, and one of the things I argue is that he is among the most important 20th century religious thinkers and like arguably the most effective. The very first thing that King ever wrote that was published under his name, Rustin wrote. And wow, is it Quaker. But no one sees it. Anyway, so that's, okay. That's my aside about Rustin. So I'll go back and talk about, so when I'm talking about Christian black internationalism, it goes way back to Protestant missions. It's in part the school connection. There's a third important connection, and that is the international Christian ecumenical movement, especially the YM and YWCA. Like now it's a place where you go to the gym maybe, but back in the day, it was very much an international movement, and it was an international movement of especially conferences where folks would go and build alliances around the world. So, and the YM and YWCA opened further international channels for black Christians. So travel under the auspices of the Y to South Asia, to West Africa, and to Europe enabled black American Christians to meet and build alliances with Christians of color around the world and to draw firsthand comparisons between colonialism and Jim Crow. So one of the things that happens when they come back is they start to see Jim Crow as a kind of colonialism. And upon their return from Asia or Africa especially, Y women and men, they spoke at churches, community centers, colleges, public forums throughout the country from the 1930s and 40s, and were sharing lessons from freedom campaigns in other parts of the world. So I think a great untold history of the movement, the civil rights movement, is the importance of the YMCAs and how they spread and shared information. Okay. So I'm about to then talk about what this looks like of a black Christian theologian taking lessons from other parts of the world. But first, I guess out of due deference to my education here at UVA, I want to underscore that looking at religion and the international roots of the civil rights movement means not only rethinking of the history of the movement, which I know you all are doing in this class, but also needs to be attentive to the history of the category of religion. I know it's the last day of school. So I'll just say that there's like a wide-ranging debate about just what religion is, and I'm sure many of you know it. The good news is it's too wide and deep to address in any detail, so I'll just hit a few points. And they're actually pretty straightforward, if surprising, if that makes sense. So I'll just say a few things about religion. The first is that the category of religion is a product of Christian understandings and priorities, particularly priorities of white European and North American Christians. So the field of religious studies started when a group of mostly Christian academics who, in developing the category of religion, gave more weight to kinds and ways of belief and practices that they knew. So what came to count as religion looks a lot like a particular kind of Christianity. That is, religion is theistic, it's concerned with doctrines, it describes individual belief and privatized practices. So if religion, the category of religion, is a product of Christian understanding, then, as Talal Hassad has argued, there are dangers in employing the category of religion when analyzing non-Christian traditions. A related issue is how religious studies, the academic discipline, grew up entangled with European colonialism, both because colonialism made available materials and religious artifacts to study, And also because religious studies tended to endorse colonial projects by promoting misunderstandings of non-Western traditions. Now, religious studies isn't alone in this. There are other departments in the university that have to grapple with this same problem. Religious studies has a particular history, though, of it. And as one scholar of Sikhism has put it, religious studies has depicted non-Western traditions as static, frozen objects, namely as phenomena to be known and studied by conceptually more advanced cultures. There is a particular history of this around the study of Indian religions. So I need to be attentive to this as the people I'm studying are going and engaging with Indian intellectuals and with Indian religions. Now, the good news is that post-colonial and decolonial theologians and religious studies scholars right now are trying to reimagine the field so that it doesn't other non-Western traditions. And Kwok Pui Lan, who's a post-colonial feminist theologian from Hong Kong and works in the United States, she was recently president of our larger guild, the American Academy of Religion. I know, very inside baseball, it's okay. She has called for religious studies to be consistently raising questions about power and knowledge. You all are thinking about this in other classes, right? About the politics of representation and following Stuart Hall, about the construction of the West and the rest. Okay. Now, this group of Black intellectuals I'm looking at is a fascinating example. I'm talking about what the work they were doing in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, but they're doing just what Kwok and others want contemporary religious scholars to do. So beginning in the mid-30s, this group was engaging thoughtfully with Indian religions, building relationships with Indian scholars and activists in the climactic years of the independence movement. And their identities, in really interesting ways, challenge a clear distinction between the West and the rest. Yes, they were Western American Christian. They were called out for this a lot, as you'll see in a minute. They were also African-descended people who were subject to the colonial conditions of Jim Crow. And as they were developing sophisticated accounts of Black religion in the United States was often denigrated as underdeveloped and irrational, as ahistorical and emotional, the same way that religious studies has othered non-Western traditions. So, okay, end of what is religion and the problems with that. With my time left, I'll turn to a concrete example from this network of Black Christian intellectuals and activists, and it's Howard Thurman's visit to South Asia, the end of 1935, beginning of 1936. I hope many of you know who Howard Thurman is. If you don't, that's okay, you will now. Howard Thurman was a great 20th century American theologian and social critic. He had been marked as a theological prodigy early on, and beginning in the mid-1920s, which were also his mid-20s, he kept a punishing schedule of giving talks about race relations all over the country. In part because of his renown, he was invited to lead the so-called Negro delegation on a pilgrimage of friendship to South Asia. And this was sponsored by the International YM and YWCA. Now Thurman, this was in 1935, and Thurman was thrilled by the chance to go to India, because he had been following Gandhi's efforts in the Indian independence movement. So to be clear, India achieves independence in 1948. So this is well before it's clear it will happen. But there's a lot of different kinds of activism and organizing going on, and the Black press, especially in the United States, was reporting all about this. So Du Bois was having Gandhi write in the crisis. So that's how, especially Black Americans knew what was happening. They were very internationally engaged, as were Indians knew what was happening in the United States. So when Thurman's there, they're asking him about the Scottsboro trials, which were still moving through the federal courts, the appeal. So people were in touch with what was happening internationally in a way that I feel like we're not as much anymore. So again, he was thrilled to go to India. He at the time was a professor of Christian ethics at Howard School of Religion. And he and his colleagues at Howard School of Religion were convinced that how the Indian independence movement was using religion, that this could be a model for an American racial justice campaign. So Thurman and the delegation went all over the subcontinent, for those of you who can imagine the geography in your head. For 5 months, they traveled the length and breadth of what is now Sri Lanka, Burma, Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan. It's a long trip today. It was a long trip then. Throughout, Thurman lectured about American politics, American history, and American religion. Near the end of the trip, Thurman met Gandhi, and he was ready, and he was excited, and he was well prepared for the meeting, and eager to ask Gandhi specifically about tactics that African Americans could use in a racial justice movement here. But Gandhi had his own pressing questions for Thurman. "Wait," he said to Thurman. "First tell me, why are you a Christian? When Christianity is associated with segregation in the United States and with colonialism around the world." Gandhi asked Thurman, "Why aren't you Muslim instead? Because in Islam there is no color line." Now, this question of why Thurman was Christian struck him. It struck him because when Gandhi asks you a question, it's striking. But it also struck him because this wasn't the first time he'd been asked. This was near the end of the trip, and he'd actually been asked the question a lot. And the exchange that had the greatest effect on him came, it was in almost one of the first speeches he gave in the trip, and it was in Colombo. He was giving a lecture in Colombo, what was then Ceylon, what is now Sri Lanka. And he wrote about this particular exchange a number of times. That is, he, like five or six different times, he published on what happened. I'll read to you from the account of that exchange that he gave in this book, Jesus and the Disinherited, which maybe some of you have read in other classes. Okay, this is Thurman writing about what happened. He said, he wrote, "At the close of a talk before the Law College, University of Colombo, on civil disabilities under states' rights in the United States, I was invited by the dean to have coffee. We drank our coffee in silence. After the service had been removed, he said to me, 'What are you doing over here? I know what the newspapers say about a pilgrimage of friendship and the rest, but that is not my question. What are you doing over here? This is what I mean. More than 300 years ago, your forefathers were taken from the western coast of Africa as slaves. Since emancipation, you have lived in a Christian nation in which you are segregated, lynched, and burned. Even in the church, I understand, there is segregation. One of my students who went to your country sent me a clipping, a newspaper account, telling about a Christian church in which the regular Sunday worship was interrupted so that many could join a mob against one of your fellows. When he had been caught and done to death, they came back to resume their worship of their Christian God. I am a Hindu. I do not understand. Here you are in my country, standing deep within the Christian faith and tradition. I do not wish to seem rude to you, but sir, I think you are a traitor to all the darker peoples of the earth. I am wondering what you, an intelligent man, can say in defense of your position." Okay. The next sentence in that is, "Our subsequent conversation lasted for more than 5 hours." It did. So what this book is it sets out to ask, that's at the beginning of the book, and this book was written in the wake of his travels throughout South Asia, especially in India. And this book sets out to ask the law professor's great question: how can Thurman call himself a Christian and not be a traitor? To answer, Thurman did what I will say any good theologian should do, a good Christian theologian should do. He started by rereading the Gospels. And when Thurman did, he saw what he always knew to be the case, but he saw it in a new way. That Jesus was a poor Jew who lived in Palestine under Roman occupation without citizenship status. So Thurman, in this book, uses the Christian story to analyze what were contemporary politics for him. In texts about the first century, Thurman perceived an existential and political crisis similar to what Black Americans experienced under Jim Crow. Thurman wrote, "The striking similarity between the social position of Jesus in Palestine and that of the vast majority of Black Americans is obvious to anyone who tarries long over the facts." Thurman's radical message was that Jesus had suffered indignities similar to those endured by Black Americans. Instead of justifying oppressive racial politics, the Bible offered strategies to resist imperialism, racism, and injustice. So by lifting up Jesus' resistance against Roman occupation, Thurman showed how the religion of Jesus could provide techniques for confronting Jim Crow. So this is his answer to how he's not a traitor. And Thurman prioritized concrete practical action. Repeatedly, he emphasized that the Gospels depict people not merely changing their hearts, but taking action. Thurman wrote, "There cannot be too great insistence on the point we are here dealing with a discipline, a method, a technique. as over against some form of wishful thinking or simple desiring. So Jesus and the Disinherited was, this book was a theological argument about the meaning of Jesus for the rejected and the oppressed. It also included a proposal for interracial cooperation. The book developed a moral framework for relationships between Black and white Americans and considered the standards of just community. So how is this going to be possible? What could this look like? And Thurman deployed a variety of sources and methods to make his argument. He used historical criticism, he appealed to his grandmother's experiences of enslavement, and he called on accounts of anti-colonial activism from around the world. So this is such a great theological text because he gets what are the authoritative sources, and he also includes his grandmother's reading strategies. I mean, it's just brilliant. There's a lot going on here. This book also contains Gandhian lessons. That is, lessons from Gandhi's movement in India. And it's a little bit tricky to see that they're there. In the whole book, and it's not a long book, but in the book, Thurman mentions Gandhi by name just once. So he quotes a letter between Gandhi and an activist in which Gandhi advises to speak the truth no matter the consequences, something Gandhi would say. But more than this singular reference to Gandhi's name, and it took me, like I taught this book like three times before when I was like, oh, like I saw, I was like, oh, it's there, I saw it. And that is that Gandhi's teachings are here in a kind of elemental but less obvious way, and that is, I'm holding the table of contents, which you can't see, but trust me, it's here. The book has Gandhian bones. The table of contents are Gandhi's program. The middle chapters, fear, deception, and hate, are antitheses of what Gandhi described as the cardinal principles of nonviolence, fearlessness, truth, and love. And Gandhi's final chapter is love. So Thurman employed Gandhi's terms, and when you read through and see how he talks about fear and fearlessness, this is in a very Gandhian way. But he used Gandhi's terms to demonstrate in the first three instances what Jesus overcame, fear, deception, and hate, and in the last instance, love, what Jesus promises. So in other words, Thurman's signal contribution to Christian theology relied on a Gandhian outlook. Its outline is Gandhian, that drew on Hinduism among other moral traditions. So there's a lot of neat stuff going on here, too, in terms of interreligious understanding. So this book grew in importance when it became a primary text of the later movement. So people who traveled with King said that he took two books with him almost everywhere. One was, of course, the Bible, and the other was Jesus and the Disinherited. So King carried with him this book that emerged in part out of international travel and a very direct challenge that Thurman see his religious tradition in a new light. And in it, Thurman outlined fearlessness, as I've mentioned, as well as reverence for personality and instructions about how to free white people from what he called our white necessity that became mainstays of King's activism and of King's great intellectual contributions to democratic theory and to Christian theology. And I want to underscore again, it's worth noting that key for Thurman's theological innovation, that the great kind of theological thinking that emerges, happens when he was challenged to give an account of himself. How are you not a traitor? And then he has to figure out what the answer is. And this is important because there is this challenge is both one of solidarity. This law professor in Colombo, I want to be in solidarity with you, he says, but I just don't think I can be. And Thurman's response is and disposition is really important. He doesn't do the thing that I think many of us do when we're called to the table. No, I didn't really mean, or no, you misunderstand, or no, you don't get it. He has moments of reflection. He tries to figure out whether or not he is a traitor and reimagine himself and his relationship to his tradition. Now, there's a really important flip side to this, that just as Thurman took seriously hard questions directed at him, he never shied away from asking difficult questions. And he was able to learn from people whose moral visions were limited. And I think this is really crucial if we are to learn anything from anyone. And so Gandhi, it turns out, is someone with a limited moral vision. Now, there's been work for a lot longer than this, but especially in the last 10 years or so, there have been important reevaluations of Gandhi's legacy, prompted by questions like, why did Gandhi exclude Black South Africans from his movement there? Could Gandhi reconcile his service in the Boer War with his later anti-imperialism? Why did Gandhi oppose untouchability but not caste? These questions suggest that Gandhi's program was not as nonviolent as he insisted it was. Well, in 1936, Howard Thurman and Benjamin Mays asked these exact questions to Gandhi himself. So Thurman, I mentioned, talked with Gandhi, and I'll talk a little bit more about their exchange. Thurman talked with Gandhi in March 1936. Later that year, Benjamin Mays went to India for a different YMCA conference that was happening in India. Benjamin Mays was at the time dean of Howard School of Religion. He leaves Howard in 1940 to go be president of Morehouse, where he's there till 1967. He's best known probably as one of King's most important mentors. King calls him one of the great influences in my life. And King arrived at Morehouse at 15 years old. He's young to arrive at college. And yeah, that's a child. And he had a difficult relationship with his father, as some of us do. And it turns out, coincidentally, that Benjamin Mays and his wife Sadie didn't have any kids. So there's lots of reasons why Benjamin Mays became more than just a mentor, became a father figure. And actually, one of the stories that King himself tells, he goes to India in 1959, that he tells about what happened when he visited a school. As best as I can tell, he never visited the school. And it was Benjamin Mays' memory and a story he began to tell in the late 30s. So, well, King was still a child. In any event, so Thurman and Mays were good friends, and they were colleagues at Howard, and they were worked together to build up what they knew. They were really well-read on Indian politics, on Indian religions, and on the history of Gandhi's organizing in India as well as in South Africa. So when they both met with Gandhi, they were ready. So, for example, so Thurman goes to ask questions, and Gandhi says, no, first, you tell me why you're Christian. So they have that conversation. And then it's Thurman's turn, and Thurman's first question to Gandhi in March 1936 is, did black South Africans play any part in your movement? So with this question, Thurman was referring to the first phase of Gandhi's career when Gandhi organized against excessive taxing and British restrictions on free movement of Indians between South African states. In South Africa, you all may know a little bit about Gandhi's work there. He founded two communes, launched a series of satyagrahas, and started a newspaper, each of which became mainstays of his work in India. And in South Africa, Gandhi's activism was largely limited to working in with expatriate Indian community of Hindus and Muslims, and with a few whites. At the turn of the century, there's a lot more to this, but in short, Gandhi thought that Indian South Africans could prove themselves worthy of British citizenship in a way that black South Africans couldn't. And so the simple answer to Thurman's question about whether Gandhi and black South Africans worked together was no. And Thurman knew this before he asked. He knew the history. But Gandhi told Thurman, in answer to respond to his question, "I purposely did not invite them. It would have endangered their cause. They would not have understood the technique of our struggle, nor could they have seen the purpose and utility of nonviolence." Now, Gandhi did not explain to Thurman why black South Africans would not have understood nonviolence, and in fact, they were already organizing nonviolently with the ANC, including with black Americans, Max Jorgen, who was there, who was friends with Thurman, so Thurman knew. But he was like trying to say, what, Gandhi? Like, what's your deal? And Gandhi didn't answer. And so then Thurman followed up and asked Gandhi, "How are we to train individuals or communities in this difficult art of nonviolence?" And Thurman answered by describing in detail ahimsa, or non-injury, and also non-cooperation, and what these might look like in the context of Jim Crow. So at the end of the meeting, it was at the end of this meeting that Gandhi proclaimed, "It may be through black Americans that the unadulterated message of nonviolence will be delivered to the world." So here we have Gandhi's benediction of the later movement. And this exchange, and this is just one of the beginning of 25 years of exchanges, from this generation of intellectuals and activists, show the significance, really, too, of critique and engagement to building effective social movements. And certainly it strikes me that these are the kinds of lessons we need today as we're developing our own, as Thurman would want us to, disciplines, methods, and techniques toward a more just social order. Thank you.
Wonderful, thank you. I know there are questions, and we have some time now. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, let's get going. Thank you again.
No, my pleasure.
Such an exciting project.
One thing we've talked about a little bit this semester in relation to SNCC was how SNCC kind of not lost its way totally, but we've used the phrase went cosmic, and that after they failed in 64, they kind of broadened their vision. And we talked about how they may have broadened their vision a little bit too much, that they lost their incarnational organizing focus. And what you were talking a lot about today was kind of broadening the vision for like what the Black experience is and how they ought to look at things. Do you see that as related to SNCC kind of going cosmic, or do you think what you're talking about can stay grounded in like the individual communities and still be effective in that way?
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. I mean, when does SNCC go to Africa? 1964-65? Yeah, so there's something happening with that too. I mean, you know, we need to be really attentive to political moments and what's working when and why. I wanna trust the young activists in SNCC and that a kind of incarnational theology that we recognize as that, they had a different sense that wasn't feeling true anymore. And when someone like Carmichael becomes Kwame Ture after Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Ture, that's a different way of understanding who he is. And he's not, I mean, one of the things that I see happening is that it's no longer an American project, that this can't be redeemed anymore. Right. So if that's the case, then your question is, what do I make of SNCC losing its way, or no?
It's more so what you're. A lot of what you talked about is very globalized, very like traveling to like the far corners of the earth and learning a lot from there. I guess my question would be: is that still able to be applicable in like local communities and everyday work?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh my goodness. I hope so.
Well, I
yes.
hope so too.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I think, you know, I think one of the things that happens for generations upon generations of all different kinds of Americans, I know the best particular history of Black Americans, and you have this Ida B. Wells and Frederick Douglass. They're an earlier generation of Black internationalists who are going especially to Ireland and to England. And something happens when you go abroad, you see yourself, but you see where you come from in a new way. So that sense of perspective, okay, the Canadian me is going to speak, is something that Americans sorely need. So one of the things that happened, I don't mean to then affirm a kind of self-referentialness in local community organizing, but it can only be a benefit for us to understand ourselves better. And one of the things that happens, I mean, I'm telling this story about Thurman, who he has to go halfway around the world for someone to say, wait, why are you Christian again? Surely he can ask himself that from home, but something happens when you travel and have to give account of yourself. You see both your home differently and you have to see yourself in a new way. So what does that mean in terms of local organizing? Well, I'm sure that means lots of things, but that means that we understand our struggles in a different scope and in different categories, and I think that's really important. So yeah, but I think one of the reasons that this kind of organizing was effective, I think, is that it was always really attuned to context, to what was happening in the Indian context, and that we can't just bring that here. We need to be understanding it idiomatically, and only then can we think about what it might look like in this context. And it took a lot of experimentation. I'm going to stop because I'm going too long. But the other thing I would say in terms of local organizing, one of the lessons, and this is a hard lesson, and depending on where you are, and I don't know where you all are politically right now in this moment, it's hard to realize things take time. So these folks came back and they're teaching Jim Farmer, who's organizing CORE, and they're organizing sit-ins and integrating buses in the 40s. They're living in the Harlem Ashram, which is just what it sounds like. And they're developing their own satyagrahas. That takes 20 years. It takes practice. And especially that's young. Like now I know 20 years isn't that long. But it feels like a long time, right? And that's the other lesson. It takes time, which is not a good lesson. That doesn't feel good. It doesn't to me.
Thank you for very fascinating contemplation of Black Christian internationalism. I want to ask about the coincidence of Thurman and Mays Howard, I suddenly remembered Ta-Nehisi Coates' designation, characterization of Howard as Black Mecca.
Yes.
And I'm interested to know if you have any thoughts about Howard specifically as a space for, historical space for the cultivation of a Black international politics. Howard specifically, at least as much as potentially religious studies that Howard.
I do. I'll say a couple things and then ask a follow-up question if I don't answer in the way that is helpful for you.
Sarah, can you just summarize that question?
Yeah, so he was reflecting on specific, especially for all of you who have read Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, and the significance of Howard to Coates, to his life, to his intellectual coming of age, and the role that Howard played, and he calls it the Mecca. And he actually talks all about the library where he sits in is right above the archives where Mays and Thurman's papers are. So I love reading that book because it's physically the same space. So, and he asked if I had any thoughts about, remember, he was reminded as I was talking about Thurman and Mays at Howard and kind of Howard specifically as an institution and the role that that played in terms of an international American democracy and religious studies. Is that right? Or theology? Okay. Howard University in the 1930s and 40s was the most democratically significant school in the country, full stop, Black or white. It was that in part because the pernicious way that segregation worked was the people who taught at Howard had all been trained at the very best places all around the country. Benjamin Mays was trained at the University of Chicago, but would University of Chicago hire Benjamin Mays? Of course not. So he had the very best training in liberal and modern theology, but also knew its problems, that it cannot talk about anti-Black racism. And so all of these folks in religious studies, you have Benjamin Mays, Howard Thurman, William Stuart Nelson, who is under-recognized but so important, but then in the rest of the university, you have the people in the law school become the folks who become the LDF, right, become a legal defense fund. You have Alan Locke, you have Mercy Tate in history, you have Rayford Logan, you have Woodson, you have, who else? You have Ralph Bunche, who lived right next door to, who was the first African-descended person to win the Nobel Peace Prize. He taught political science, and he lived right next door to Howard Thurman. So Howard is ridiculously important. And what happens is segregation meant that Mordecai Johnson was trying to build the best Black university, ended up building like one of the best universities. And one of the things especially that's happening in the School of Religion is the kind of work that's happening at Howard is so theologically and democratically significant. So I teach at Union, and like Reinhold Niebuhr's ghost roams the hallways. And Union is so important in terms of the history of social gospel, and especially for me in Christian ethics, it's really important, the history of social ethics that comes through Union, and in terms of theology also. However, if you want to talk about the kind of theology and social ethics that had an effect in American politics, I'll make the case any day. Not at my school, but here, I'll make the case that Howard was much more effectual. And there's lots of reasons why, but in part you have this incredible brain trust. But you also have this incredible brain trust that is not living in the ivory tower in the way that white academics can and do. They're living in segregated D.C., and the history of D.C. at the time, before the war in Rwanda, is one of persistent and pervasive segregation, as it is today, frankly, but it takes different shape. So am I answering your question? So yeah, and I'll say one more thing, and that is, what is his name? He teaches at Vanderbilt, and he's a lovely man, and he's writing a biography of William Stuart Nelson. It flew out of my head. But he makes the argument that what was happening at Howard in terms of Black theology, well, it's not called that yet, right, but proto-Black theology and Black church studies is as important in religious studies as the Harlem Renaissance was to literature, but that's what's happening in Howard in the 30s and 40s.
Thank you. Other questions, please? Thank this is... just terrific. This man over here.
Thank you, Professor Yetsky. This was really great. You framed much of the talk in more in personal terms as these individual people going over and stuff. Is there a kind of parallel institutional story you could tell us about the institutions? I think the line about Howard is one line to pursue here. And if so, are there any kind of reasonably portable lessons you have for institutions today that would maybe want to talk to other institutions elsewhere in the world that could learn from them?
Yeah. Yes. So there's another way to tell this story, and it ends up kind of in the book as subtext. This is also a story of majority white institutions that are dragged along, white organizations like the Fellowship of Reconciliation, American Friends Service Committee, are two examples. Both, one's Quaker and one's Quaker Friend. You can look at Howard. You can certainly look at the YM and YWCA. I think there's a way in which the segregation in the Y, which was segregated till 1946, also ironically enabled black leadership in the Y, and so enabled folks to... black Christians to be able to go and travel internationally to represent their black wives. So all that's to say, there's absolutely a way that I could flip it and be telling it organizationally and not individually. And in fact, the book operates sometimes that way. Now, your question, though, of like what lessons? So a couple things are necessary. One, in the case of Howard School of Religion, you had, a couple things I say are really important. One is that the president of the school, Mordecai Johnson, believed that it mattered that his professors, and when they were traveling, when you went to India in 1936, that's a 2-month boat trip. That's not like a day and a half on a plane. Like, that's a long time. So for him to say to his staff, yes, you can go, I trust you, because it's going to be work that they're going to come back to, and they write letters back and forth to each other about how I read your letter in class. I told them what Gandhi said. So all of the students then are able to access that internationalism. So first of all, you need leadership who's willing and able to allow that, and you need someone to cover the classes when they're not there. No, but really, I mean, that's the bureaucratic stuff, right? The other stuff that I think, the other part that's really important, I don't know whether or not it's worth telling this story in a really personal way, but the other thing that's really important is you gotta do your homework. I will say it's not unknown in academic circles for there to be junkets, for you to get a chance to go on a trip and go to, name the place. Why don't you go to Indonesia? Well, do we have to learn about it first? Do we have to learn something in the language and the traditions? And there's a lot of times when that doesn't happen. Now, one of the things that happened that made this work was they did their homework. They knew about Gandhi, they knew about Indian religions, they were tutored and they knew. That's also necessary. And then they need the wherewithal to withstand difficult questions. Right? Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Other questions, please. Professor Haler Fatan, my colleague Cindy Haler.
I'm wondering, you mentioned, talking about this Christian black internationalism. Was there any, in the 1930s, of course, in Paris, there are a lot of West African, who are spearheading the Negritude movement, Mirabeau Diop, and they're very important for a certain international pan-African anti-colonial movement, at least within West Africa and other parts of the Francophone world. And I'm wondering if is there any engagement with that network?
A little bit and not enough. So did you all hear that? So she's asking specifically about, so as I'm talking and you may have picked up on, we're dealing, the kind of anti-colonial and post-colonial and colonial encounters the people I'm talking about are having, or especially having encounters with people who were English colonies. So there's a whole other, that's a both different philosophical tradition and also a matter-of-factly different linguistic tradition of especially West African in Paris as well as throughout West Africa and especially Senegalese, yeah. So the answer is yes, but not so much. So a few examples I could give, and he's not exactly part of this, but In 1921, Rayford Logan and William Stuart Nelson both are 22-year-old precocious ex-Army officers who speak French fluently. And they are tagged by Du Bois to be translators at his Pan-African conference in Paris. It was happening in three places, Paris, London, Brussels. And the conference was almost not going to happen because Blaise Diagne, who was from Senegal and he was a Senegalese leader, he wanted to scuttle it because, well, a lot of reasons, but because he didn't like Du Bois was usurping the Pan-African movement, and it's an African movement, not an American movement. And so that became a point of especially interaction. And for especially Rustin, who spent a lot of time in France, he knew and was friends with a lot of the folks who were engaged in. He knew, he himself spoke and read French. And William Stuart Nelson, actually, this is another, I'm skipping back and forth. William Stuart Nelson, in 1923, wrote La Race Noire La race noire dans la démocratie américaine, the black race in American democracy, and he wrote it in French. So he was engaged in those even earlier with those folks. Now, one of the reasons why it doesn't happen as much is language, but also politics. So Rustin was really engaged in West Africa in the early 50s, wanted to be traveling to the French colonies, but couldn't because he had been protesting at the French embassy in the United States, and they refused him a visa. So that ended up curtailing, and he became incredibly important to so many of these connections happening. So a little bit, but not so much. And so a lot of like the negritude, and yeah, I don't know if that just yeah.
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 Thanks so much for that wonderful talk. I was wondering if you could shed any light on the development of Nation of Islam, which is happening in the 1930s or so, and this story of Black internationalism. Is there any connection or crossover synergy? Could you shed light on the relationship between these institutions and this kind of international consensus that you're drawing our attention to?
Yeah, absolutely. So, so this is not something I talk about for a couple reasons. Primarily because what I'm looking at are Christian intellectuals and activists who, also because of geography, like, so I'm looking because of Howard. So in part because they're engaged in the academy in D.C., there are folks who are in New York, and so especially Rustin knows about what's happening in the Nation of Islam. You know, the other thing that's, so yes, insofar as what they share politically, they share meetings, so they're going to Garvey meetings, but Garvey also is this interesting person historically because there are now historians who are looking at him as a kind of black Judaism. But what they all have in common is the kind of general internationalism that shapes the black press. And so this becomes a political affiliation that then they have different relationships to it, depending on their institutional affiliations, depending on if they're church people or not. But the fact of the development of the NOI at this moment is just an indication of internationalism that was in the air. And yeah. But they're not related to the people I talk about. I mean, they become engaged later.
Another question here.
I'm not exactly sure how or what I really want to ask, but I guess I'd like to hear more on what you know about like Gandhi's relationship to Christianity, Christians in South Africa, Christians in India, and how like Thurman might have even like approached that, like knowing, yeah, very like being law school and being religious, but also maybe like how Christianity and colonialism was viewed in Africa, and in India, and maybe that transferred into how it was thought of in the past, and in terms of colonialism and Christianity, or how maybe it wasn't.
Okay.
Can you just go through some more ways?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're asking, or this is what I'm going to try to answer. You're asking, if I could talk a little bit more about Gandhi's relationship to Christianity.
And how he thought that colonialism and Christianity were
intertwined. And how he thought that colonialism and Christianity were intertwined. And he's not alone in thinking that, by the way. Okay, yes, I can talk more about that. Okay. let me just pause, though, and take this opportunity to say that you know, I because I'm only talking here for like a few minutes, I'm talking about this exchange that Thurman has with Gandhi. And Thurman has really interesting other important, and so this is my aside and then I'll answer your question. Thurman has really other important interactions with especially religious intellectuals and religious studies scholars. One example is Tagore, who you all may have heard of, who was arguably the first cosmopolitan international intellectual, and he had just written, he had just published this series of lectures he'd given on Oxford about religion, about what is religion, and he had started a school in Calcutta, and he was world-renowned, and Gandhi was so excited to meet him, and had read, and were there for an interview, and the guy was like kind of out of it. He was just not very present. And it was too bad, and you know, he at that point, it turns out, was dying, was experiencing a lot of pain, so it could be they didn't have a good exchange because of that. At the same school, there's someone named Cam Sen who worked there, who was a scholar of Indian religions, and I'm not going to get it right, but I'll paraphrase. Thurman said that he had the most naked fusing of his soul that he'd ever had with any other person, with this Hindu who was also a scholar of Indian religions. He is, coincidentally, this is very inside, for those of you who know, the grandfather of Amartya Sen, the Nobel-winning economist. And Amartya Sen would have been at the time three and was born and grew up on the university, so like maybe Thurman saw him paddling around. But, so he's like intellectual, right? So all that to say, he had encounters with lots of other Indian intellectuals and Hindu intellectuals. Now, about Gandhi and his relationship with Christianity, we know that. Gandhi knew a lot about Christianity. He knew the Gospels pretty well. And when people challenged him, he could like quote back, especially the Gospel of Matthew. He uses the Gospel of Matthew a lot. So he knew the story. He also knew the story because you all may know he had, before Tolstoy died, he had a correspondence with Tolstoy. He was really taken with Tolstoy's, is it called The Kingdom of God? And he wrote back and forth with Tolstoy. Yeah. And so there's a way in which Gandhi is annoyingly eclectic. Right? Like he's just, when we think about like multiple moral traditions, Gandhi was thinking with multiple moral traditions. And though Gandhi also saw so when Gandhi talks about Christianity as being implicated with colonialism and segregation, I think this is one of the things that it just is. And like, take my word on it if you don't know, but it is. It's like, that's the history. And one of the things that Thurman does, in part after this meeting, but he was already figuring it out, is Thurman begins to distinguish between Christianity as kind of a dominant type of the tradition that aids and abets white supremacy, that Christianity is different from the religion of Jesus. And so this begins kind of that distinction, and it's one that I think Gandhi himself knew and practiced. And so one time someone, it was William Stuart Nelson, who's another black theologian who spent a year in India and meets Gandhi multiple times, and asked Gandhi in 1947, and this is at this point, it's right before partition and independence, but Gandhi is despairing because there's violence everywhere, and Gandhi thinks nonviolence has failed. And he says to, and Nelson says to Gandhi, but this is the truth, you know this is true. And he said, I don't know what's true. And in answering it, he ends up quoting part of the Gospel of Matthew in order to make an argument about what truth really is. And he makes an argument using Jesus' own terms. So there you have someone who's not Christian, but, and so this important distinction too, between someone who recognizes the extent to which dominant Christianity, he's seen, it's about spreading colonialism throughout India, but that the religion of Jesus remains a moral resource for him.
You talked about the loss of Rustin's religious voice because he was a Quaker and...
Well, lots of reasons, but yeah.
Right, but one of the things you mentioned was like a failure to kind of recognize like Quaker as a standpoint of doing theology, and I think that's really interesting in light of the fact that like peace traditions more largely have like been really active in civil rights and a lot of social movements. Yeah, and so I think I'm interested in why that scholarship kind of gets obscured and lost.
It's a great question. I will say that for those of you, and I know people in the room know her, Rachel Muirs, who is herself a Quaker scholar and writes from that perspective, she has a fantastic book called, is it called Quaker Theological Ethics? I don't know, something like that, which is beautiful. And in it, she uses some of Rustin's work to exemplify Quaker theological thinking. So she's one of the only people I've ever seen do that. So all that to say, it's out there. But you ask, like, how does it get missed, or why does it get missed?
It gets missed in Rustin's case specifically for a couple reasons. One, because of bad history. So you, is it David Chappelle? I always don't want to call him that because the other David Chappelle.
Same,
okay.
Same name.
Very different person. Who wrote The Stone of Hope, that's a history of the movement. And he writes a lot about Rustin, and he calls him a former Quaker.
He calls him a former Quaker
and says that the reason why he had problems with King is because of King's religiosity, and he himself was secular. Well, Rustin was a member of meetings, of Manhattan Monthly Meeting, his whole life. And you don't need, well, whatever. He was a member of meeting, and not all people who identify as Quaker and go to meeting are members of meeting. So it's like an extra important step to be a member of meeting. So that's why it gets missed. It also gets missed because, yes, Quakers have a wonderful history of abolition, right, in abolition, and in prison reform, and in feminism. But one of the best histories of Quakers on race, this will give you an answer to why people don't consider Rustin, I think, is called Fit for Freedom, Not for Friendship. And yeah, they're right. Good title. Because it underscores why aren't there a lot of Black Quakers? Quakers are a pretty white group. Not exclusively, but pretty. And so there's a way in which I think he's not seen as Quaker for lots of reasons. But why else? Because people just don't read him. You can, but if you do read him, you can't read him and like miss it. He quotes the Sermon on the Mount. He talks about the cross. He talks about what God wants. He talks about, but what's interesting about him is his kind of moral reasoning is different, and you see it throughout. He talks about means have to align with ends, and that you can't have good ends and use means that don't work, because it's not going to work. So I mean, the obvious example is you can't aim for peace with violent means. You can't stockpile weapons in order to aim for peace. So you have to do the right thing. And his the other thing he underscores over and over again is you need to do the right thing and not know what's going to work out. I mean, he has a really profound Christian conviction that doing the right thing, we might not know now, but it's not our job to know. God knows. No, I recommend reading Rustin. Yeah.
We have time for one more quick question, if there is one. May I ask a quick one? So one story that keeps tantalizing me on this matter of the global origins of the civil rights movement is that of about 50 Jewish scholars from Germany and Poland who leave during the intellectual migration from Nazi Germany and end up teaching at historically Black colleges in the Deep South. And there's this self-published book I ran across a couple of years ago, and it actually has a list of the universities, so Frankfurt, Hamburg, Berlin, and where these scholars ended up, Tuskegee, Tougaloo, right? So and to my knowledge, you know, that's still a largely untold story. And does that make its way into your narrative, or can you make some connections for us?
Yeah, it only makes it into my narrative in a very bad way. And that is that as most Christian theologians in the wake of the Second World War did not account for how Christian theology needed to be accountable to what had just happened. Mm-hmm. That Christian theology's role in enabling the Holocaust to happen needed to be something not just Jewish theologians who survived needed to reckon with in their own theology, but it needed to transform Christian theology, and boy did it not, I think it's fair to say. And one of the people who was speaking out most keenly against this was actually Benjamin Mace. And he was very alert to how anti-Judaism in Christian churches was even creeping into Black churches. And he was someone who, when he was at Morehouse, was really a leader in general in the HBCUs, and he was one of the ones who helped to get placement of folks. Mm. But he was, in some ways, speaking against the wind and really arguing that as we are engaging with other traditions, we Christians need to be accountable for Jewish brothers and sisters, and especially we Black Christians have a special accountability. Mm-hmm. And so much came of that.
No, it's not.
There you go.
Well, this is such wonderful way not only to conclude the semester,
yeah,
but to launch us on, you know, just many fascinating paths of reading and research and reflection. Let's give Professor Azaransky a big